My name's Wayne Pekarsky. I'm from the Wearable Computer Lab at the University of South Australia. And today I'm going to talk about AR Quake and how we modified Quake to work on our augmented reality backpack. So I've brought all my toys with me this time around. I've talked previously at other LCA conferences, and because our gear was really messy and stuff, it was really hard to bring it. I brought it once, but it was a bit of a nightmare. But I've got all the equipment here, and we'll get talking about that in a minute. So hopefully everyone knows what Quake is. Quake's this game where you can run around and shoot monsters and play levels and stuff like that. It's a 3D desktop virtual reality game, so you're completely immersed in the game. You use your arrow keys or your mouse to drive around the game or whatever, and that's how you play it. Now, we play Quake on our backpack computer. So what it is we have this little computer here. You fold it up, you put it on your back, and you take it around outside. It has all the necessary equipment to drive the Quake game, and we'll get talking about that in a minute. So what happens is that we use a head-mounted display, not a monitor, so you use a set of virtual reality goggles to play the game. So it gives you the impression that, like, if the graphics are realistic enough, it gives you the feeling that you're there, rather than looking at it on a monitor. Computer monitors, because they're quite small and they're a distance from your head, don't give you the sense of immersion that you can get with a really good head-mounted display. So what happens is you walk around the real world, and Quake can draw virtual monsters into your vision. So as you're walking around, there'll be monsters that appear on the ground, and you can shoot at them and run around and do stuff. So this is called augmented reality, and we'll talk a bit more about some other augmented reality things later on. Now, I gave a talk in 2000 in Sydney, and I talked in 2001, and I showed videos of various augmented reality things that we've worked on, and the technology has improved just incredibly since then. We now have 3D hardware and laptops. People want to play games on their laptops, so there's been a push for manufacturers to embed hardcore graphics chipsets into laptops, and it's really cool because anything that's good for games is also good for what I do, because my stuff is all 3D graphics, rendering, and so forth, so it's really important. And everything you've seen of my stuff previously is all obsolete now. So I'll show you a video of the first version. So in Sydney I showed one video, and this was the first AR Quake system. This was shot with a video camera through the head-mounted display, and you could move it around and there's a little monster and it kills you, and that's about it. And doing these videos is really hard. The quality of it is all not very fancy and everything like that. This is something we did with very primitive hardware. It was a Pentium 200 or something like that. So it did work, and that was our first sort of prototype. And I showed this, and everyone was just like, oh, wow, oh, my God. And I looked at it. I looked at the video and just went, oh, this is terrible. We should do so much better than this. So fortunately, hardware has come to the rescue, and now we have really kick-butt 3D chipsets in our laptops now. So at the previous conference, I had a laptop which had 3D support in an ATI Rage, but the Rage chipset was good for doing 3D. It can run Quake 3, but it can't take video texture maps from a camera in real time. We'll talk about that in a minute. But anyway, what we're demonstrating today is the new AR Quake, which we've worked on recently, and that's the next video. So this one here is, you can see monsters running around outside. Okay, so if you go around outside, virtual monsters are hovering over the landscape, and as you turn around, you can shoot them, you can do stuff like that. And the monsters all float into space, so they're locked in into a physical location, and they can move around. So, unfortunately, the software, we haven't quite worked out how to make it interact with real objects yet. That's a work in progress. So the new version that I just showed there is sort of our latest attempt at it. You can see that the quality was a lot sharper. You can see the monsters, cool sound, everything like that. It works a lot better, and that's the one that we've got here to demo this time around. So, now, I've said this last year, and I said this the year before. Hacking is not just about software. It's also about modifying your hardware. So my Dell Inspiron laptop here, we opened it all up, and we sewed in a little power switch in it so we could start it while the clamshell was closed. Things like that. So I told these guys, I said, oh, I want to solder a power switch in there. And they're like, oh, we don't want to touch your laptop, man. I was like, give me the tools, we'll just do it. So we used drills, power saws, sticky tape, and lots of bits and pieces to make our own gear. So the backpack there is a sort of a collection of various bits and pieces that's all been combined together. And you make mistakes. We've toasted a couple hard drives. We've toasted some USB ports and put the wrong voltage from the battery into it. We've toasted a whole pile of stuff. I'm plugging stuff in, it blew up, and I'm like, oh. I put it in my other computer, it didn't work, so I plugged three more devices before I finally worked out that the hub was toasting everything that plugged into it. So what you can do is you get hardware mods and software mods and you combine them together to get even more fun. And it also means you get really stressed out because stuff just doesn't work. Hardware breaks, cables snap. Software is really cool because you've got this virtual machine abstraction that you've got this kernel that makes everything just nice for you and you just do things and it all works. However, when you've got hardware that's flaky, the whole thing just goes out the window. And when you've got equipment with a cable that's glitchy or something, it just causes untold amounts of grief, and that hardware can be pretty evil sometimes. It stops you getting bored, yeah, but I get really stressed out and angry. But, so what we do is we have what's called a head-mounted display. The one in the photo is called a Sony Glasstron. That's worth about $6,000. We bought that about 3 years ago. They don't sell that one anymore, and it's the finest head-mounted display ever made. It's 800 by 600 LCD crystals. This display here is about a third of that resolution, but this one costs $500. So we bring this with us because I can afford to have them broken. I can't afford to break that one because I can't buy a replacement for it. So there's an example of an augmented reality photo. So you can see in the background we've got some grass and some buildings, and then the computer has drawn in some tables and trees and objects and so forth. Later on I'll actually show a video. This is what I actually really do for my work. The Quake game is just this thing that we did on the side. But so that's augmented reality, when you're overlaying 3D graphics, and the 3D graphics is locked into physical space. So we have a backpack system. So that's the backpack I showed you over here. There's a photo of it in use outside. So it sits on your shoulders. But the backpack is designed so that you can split it apart and you can place it down. The laptop sits here. The laptop's over there. I'm using it for my talk. But what happens is you can fold everything out and you can pop down a little tray table. And so you can put the laptop on here and you can do coding outside if you need to fix up a bug or something like that. But it's generally pretty evil. You don't want to mess with that. The way we do the software is that you basically have to get the software perfect indoors using simulation. Once you're really sure it's going to work, then you take it outside. Because when you go outside, it's hard to type. You've got this goofy little keyboard and it's just evil. So this backpack here was actually built for us by a team of engineers from DSTO. In Sydney, I brought my other backpack. And the problem with that one is it had tons of bits and pieces and so forth. If we actually go to the next slide, you can see the old backpack versus the new backpack. So I took something similar to that one to Sydney, and I stripped it down. I had to take all the gear off it to take it with me. All the GPSs and everything go into my carry bag. Everything else goes in the suitcase. And the one on the left took me about 3 hours to tape and put back together again. This one here, the new one, I can pop it off a plane and have it working in about 15 minutes now. So it makes my life real easy. So this thing was built for us by these dudes at the Defence Science Technology Organisation. They wanted to play with augmented reality as well for various reasons. And so what they did is they said, well, look, we'll give you 10 engineers for 3 months to build you this backpack. And I don't know how much that would cost, probably $50,000 or $100,000 or whatever. But they gave me these engineers, said, look, you teach these guys how to build the backpack that you want. And they had everything. They have drill presses and machinery, there's electronic CNC tools and all this kind of stuff. So they can make pretty much everything. And the deal was that, well, they can make copies of it after, but then I get to keep the one that they made for me and I got it for nothing. So that was pretty good value from our point of view. So it has a big battery in it. It has multiple voltages to power the different kinds of devices, so USB devices, FireWire. We have things like USB ports on the shoulder straps, so you can plug in USB devices. As a speaker, I got given this really cool fan. So you can plug that into the USB port on the front and keep yourself cool with it, so that's definitely going to come in handy. And so all the devices are all mounted in there. We use this really cool plastic Velcro, which is used to bolt the components down. And using 4 pieces of this special Velcro the size of the tip of your finger, you can suspend a laptop and it won't fall off. I didn't trust it though, so we put straps around it as well. I can't afford my laptop to fall off. So everything's held on with cable ties. The back plane of the backpack has all got holes in it so you can run cable ties through it. Later on you can have a look at it. So the thing runs for about 2 hours, it weighs 15 kilos and it hurts your back after a while. We're actually doing some work to replace the back plate with a better one that fits a lot nicer, because that one's got some problems. So it's an iterative design thing where I play with it, I take it back to them and say, fix this up, and they go, okay, and then we'll gradually go through that. So it's travel friendly though, in that I've got this suitcase which has got all hollowed out foam that you can put the backpack into it and chuck it on an airplane and you can travel with it quite easy. So I take it places now, which is really good, so at least I can show it to people. So that's the backpack. The trick with doing this kind of stuff is you cannot use mobile input devices. So keyboards and mice are out. So the picture there, you can see me trying to type on a keyboard. It just doesn't work because you really need a table to put the keyboard on. So these devices are designed to work on a table or a surface of some kind. You don't have that when you're walking around outside. Having a little arm, a keyboard on your arm doesn't work either because they're too tiny, the keys are awful, and it's just bad news in general. You want to touch type and you can't do it. So when you want to do AR type stuff, you really need new input devices. So my PhD work has been with how do you design new user interfaces for augmented reality. At the end of this talk, I'll show you some slides of my real work that I do. So what we've done is we've created some new input devices to control Quake. So with Quake, you control it by walking around, you control it by moving your head, and you also control it using these custom little plastic guns that we've built. So I have this one here with me. This one here is what we call the duck gun. I bought it from a toy shop for like $4.50, and it blows bubbles here on the computer. So I whipped it open and 2 hours ago, and then we've got a USB mouse embedded inside here. And so the cool part about it is it's an absolutely standard USB connector. You can plug it in, and Quake can see it, and there's nothing you have to do. The original one we had on the bottom was another custom gun that we built. However, that one required a parallel port interface. And parallel port programming is evil. You've got to be root. You've got to... You run the risk of killing everything. It's just bad news in general trying to talk to your printer. And it's very CPU intensive to just bang to this gun and so forth. So it worked. The cool part about this gun was that it had a haptic feedback thing. So inside the gun, it had this big solenoid with a metal bolt on it. And as you fired it, it would go chunk, chunk, and it recoiled. And it gives you this feedback effect. And what you would do is for each kind of weapon you fired, it would have a different recoil, and so you could, it just gave you this feedback to make it feel like you were shooting something. This one doesn't do it. The problem with the haptic feedback is it drained the battery in about 45 minutes, so we didn't really, it's not very friendly to use it, so we tend to use this one. This one's also cool because it doesn't look very threatening, and so you can walk around with it and no one really says anything to you, whereas the other gun just looks too menacing. So there's a photo of me using it on my boss. So that's the gun. So the cool part about the gun is how you control the game. The gun has a firing button, which is pretty obvious. I took this thing to Spain, and I demoed it to 200 computer geeks, this thing called Campus Party. And most of them didn't speak English, and all I had to do was give it to them, and they went, okay, and they just started using it. It's pretty obvious how the game works. You don't need to master a command line or anything to make it work. You just use the gun. It's intuitive. So to measure where your body is, in order for the computer to draw the graphics to line up correctly with the environment, you've got to have some kind of input to tell the computer where it is. So we have a GPS which measures our current position. This one is called a Trimble AG 132. This is a surveying grade one. It measures to about 50 centimeter accuracy and it gives you 10 updates per second. If you compare that to a standard GPS, like a little handheld unit, like this one here, these things are about 5 meter accuracy. They give you one update per second. There's lag in it of about 2 seconds added on top of that as well. So these things are just generally not all that crash hot. So this one costs about $8,500, but you get good quality. Now, you can actually get 2 centimeter level tracking using what's called real-time kinematics. And those ones, they cost about $50,000 here, I think. I can't really afford that right now. But those things, you get 2 centimeter level tracking. So as you walk around, it's really, really accurate. So that's sort of where it's all going. So the tracking is pretty much there. It's just a cost thing right now. To do the orientation sensing, there's a little black cube on the head plus a little processing box. The little processing box has a 486 in it that runs a Kármán filter. This is something you purchased. We didn't make it or anything like that. But it gives you 30 updates per second, and it tells you where your head's looking. So it gives you pitch, roll, and heading information so that as you move your head, the game can keep everything in sync as well. Otherwise, it doesn't look realistic. So the goal of all this tracking equipment is we're trying to keep the virtual and real world locked onto each other so that as you move around, they synchronize with each other. So this tracker here is a magnetic and gyroscopic-based one. You can get cheaper ones, but the quality suffers in that they jitter a lot. What will happen is, if the tracker is not good enough, you'll have this monster floating in front of you, but then it'll jump around, and it's not very smooth. The really, really expensive trackers are very accurate, and they lock on quite nicely. And for about $50,000 or $100,000, I can't remember, you can buy this one which has coils of fiber optic cable in it, which will measure your accuracy. It drifts like half a degree per day or hour or something like that. That's the one I really want for Christmas, but Santa didn't give it to me. So I can only hope next year, maybe. So what you can do with all this expensive gear is you put it all together and you can go around and play Quake outside. So what I'll do now is I'll just show a few more videos. Well, second patch, I realized that that was also the game shape. Since then, I've actually patched that stuff out. This is another map here showing just some objects that we've created. So as you turn your head around, you can see that they're locked in space. There's like a tree, some health boxes, a few things, and they all float in space. Now, the tracking is not perfect. You can see that the objects jitter around a little bit. Since then, we've actually improved it slightly by putting some filtering in. To make it a bit better. But this is sort of the best you can get. And there's also lag in that the tracker is always 30 milliseconds behind. So when you move around, because the tracker is delayed by 30 milliseconds, when you move, everything sort of swims and it's a bit behind. And also you have refresh delay caused by the 3D rendering hardware rendering at, say, 60 frames a second. Well, 60 frames a second means there's another 30 milliseconds of delay. So once you add all these delays up, plus your processing time, plus kernel switching, plus everything else, you end up with this delay that causes objects to be a bit behind and so forth. So these are, it's very hard to actually do this stuff really well. So there's actually been some work with these guys we're doing where as the CRT gun was drawing the pixels out, they in real time calculated the 3D pixel to draw at that coordinate so that that way it would always be as accurate as possible. It's really hard to do though, so people don't tend to mess with it too much. I'll show one more video. This is back to the So you see grenades set up and cover the space and then... Yeah, the way I've set it up actually is I have it in God mode normally for my videos because the monsters are just out of point and it's too hard to outrun them. They tend to be quite tough. Like right now I'm getting pounded by about 6 guys and I can't really run away all that much. So I have God mode set up in God mode, it just makes things easier to get. Well, you'd have to. Okay, the trick is if you want to have Quake model real, like the bouncing of a grenade off a real object, you have to put into Quake the models for the real objects so that it can do the physics modeling for it. So if you're patient enough and you can put the models in, yes, you can do it. And Quake just does this for free. It, like, we don't have to do it. Okay, this is all very hard. Using video cameras to capture 3D geometry is a complete nightmare, and it's an unsolved research problem. And there are heaps of people working on it, but it hasn't been done yet. So, the texture's overlay, we're going to talk about that in a minute. So as you can see, I mean, the quality of this video is a lot better than the old one we had. So what we did was, I'll talk a bit about how we modified the game to do all this stuff. What happened was we took the Quake 1 source code that was released by ID Software, and what we did was is we modified it. So now Quake uses relative positions normally. So what happens is internally it keeps X, Y, Z coordinates and it keeps heading pitch roll values. Now when you use the arrow key or the mouse, you hit forward, the game moves forward, and what happens is it adds an offset to the current position that you're at. So if you're currently standing here and you hit the forward key, the game jumps forward. And if you hit the backwards key, it jumps backwards and so forth. But it always moves relative to where you're standing. So what happens is you could interface the GPS so that every time you move forward a meter, it sends the up arrow command to the game or whatever. But the mapping for it would be a nightmare. And also what you find is that over time, you'll accumulate errors and you'll eventually be in the wrong position in the game. So what happens is we hack Quake so that it receives UDP packets from the network from another process. There's this process that reads the GPS and the head tracker. It then injects UDP packets into the game that have X, Y, Z, and heading, pitch, and roll. That's taken from my sensors. And then Quake, we have some code in there that receives UDP packet and drives those values in. So if you try to use the arrow keys to play the game, the second a new update comes in, it sends you back to where the GPS and head tracker want you to be. So the GPS and head tracker take control of Quake's movement and heading, pitch, and roll, and so forth. So we made some modifications to do that. That's probably the most important part because that's the bit that makes the Quake game run. So what happens is AR Quake basically maps to the real world. So you can't do things like flying and swimming and other crazy kind of tasks because you need to be able to do it in real life. The thing with Quake is that you can do crazy things like jumping and then turning around and flying backwards. And you can change direction while you're in flight as you've jumped in the air and stuff like that. You can't do that in the real world. So Quake can only do everything you can do yourself. So if you want to run, you have to run. If you want to walk, you've got to walk. Currently, you can't do things like crouching because we don't measure the altitude from the GPS sensor. But you could put that in if you wanted to. So you have to obey the laws of physics. That's pretty important. the user also, if you want to walk in the game, now I was actually looking through my Linux brochures last night that came in my bag, and there was this one thing that said find 30, it's not a big exercise, and it talked about getting exercise and stuff. And this could be the next big thing to encourage geeks to get out there and play games in the real world and get fit and stuff like that. So, you know, rather than sitting in front of the TV playing games, you actually now put the game on and go outside. So if you're not fit, then you won't do very well. So it's encouraging you to play better. So, I mean, this is really an over-glorified electronic paintball game, really. Except you've got electronic people to play against rather than real people. So you can't swim, you can't jump, you can't climb. You can't do crazy stuff like that because the GPS basically has to allow you to do it. You can't press a run key to make yourself move faster because where you're standing is where the game puts you. You have to move there if you want to go somewhere. So what you can do, though, is you can do crazy things like walking backwards and shooting like this. And you can shoot in a direction independent of the direction you're walking. The way Quake generally works is that if you want to move in that direction, you have to look in that direction, and you always have to shoot in the same direction as you're looking and walking. This here allows you to separate them because of the way the GPS and the head sensor interact with it. No. Because the thing is because we've hacked into the XYZ and heading control values, we just put in a new position that says we're over here, but we're looking there. And you can easily do that kind of stuff without having any problems. Whereas due to the way that Quake decodes the arrow key, if you hit the forward arrow key, it moves you in the direction that you're looking, because that's what makes sense. So we have a few advantages and we have a few disadvantages. Because of the fact that you can't run and you can't do crazy stuff, what that really means is that when you're playing against these monsters, it's very hard to get away from them, because most of the monsters can run electronically a lot faster than you can. So the trick when you're designing levels is you have to use monsters that are slow, you have to use ones that are a bit stupid. You don't want monsters that are really hardcore and powerful because they'll just chase you down and get you. You don't really have much of a chance. Because Quake has a lot of... Like, when you run in Quake, you're running a lot faster than you can run in the real world. And you can do things that you can never normally perform. The other thing is, in Quake, by clicking the mouse, you can turn 180 degrees instantaneously. But as a human, it takes a certain amount of time to do it properly and then adjust your head for it. And Quake allows you to do rotations and jumping and actions that just would kill you if you try to do it in the real world. So, it doesn't work very well when you move fast. The video blurs, the head tracking falls behind. It's best when you do it slowly. I mean, this is not the kind of thing where you can take it out into the jungle and play games with it. It's a prototype that, okay, you can stand here and shoot and stuff like that, but you can't really abuse it. The technology is just not good enough to be able to play it like you would play a real game. Yeah. I'll get to that in a sec. I'll cover that question in a second when I talk on the next slide. Okay. Now, this is a limitation of the Quake game. What happens is, with the gun is not tracked. So the computer does not know which direction the gun is pointing when I shoot it around. So what happens is that the way the game's set up and the way Quake works is that Quake always shoots at the crosshair in the center of your display when you're shooting. So what happens is if you want to shoot up there, you look up, and the bullets will fire along the axis of your eyes, but the computer can't track the location of your hand. It doesn't matter. The gun is a prop that you're using to shoot with, but it's not aimed. This is a limitation of the Quake system in that it doesn't have the ability to mess with the guns like this. You could do it, but there's too much work involved, and I'll talk more about that later on. Sorry? Okay, but the problem is how are you going to track the location of the gun? No. What sensor are you going to put onto this gun? Okay, this is a big problem, okay? Okay, but what I'm trying to say is tracking your guns and stuff like that is a massive problem that's not trivial. Like, I use vision tracking on my gloves and my other stuff. But what happens is you have to keep your hands within the view of the camera that's in front of you. If you want to shoot over here somewhere, you need a tracker, and this tracker does not exist. It is not possible to buy a tracking device you can take outside that is really workable and stuff like that. The tracking technology just doesn't work yet. No, but what I'm saying is shoehorning all that into Quake is also quite interesting in that you've got to somehow map the location of the gun and make it shoot in the right direction. It's non-trivial. The GPS is not accurate enough. Okay, you could do something like that, but the problem is if you do this kind of motion, you've broken it. So, I mean, you can do certain things, but it just depends on how realistic you want it to be. You can actually cause more problems for yourself by doing that, because by having an assumption where you say, okay, we'll assume that the gun's always pointed in the right direction with an angle sensor. If a person tries to use it, when they start doing actions like this, it'll do crazy stuff and it won't make much sense. This thing doesn't have any tracking at all, but at least by saying to them, look, it just shoots through the cursor in the middle of the display, it makes it really easy to understand. And it depends on what you want to implement. You could do this kind of stuff. It depends on how much money you've got, what kind of tracking equipment you have, and a variety of things and what you're willing to try. We haven't really looked into that too much yet. Later on, I'll show some more stuff with some vision tracking. But what are you going to see? You need something to see through your head, though. And it'll be very confusing if you've got the camera here, but you're seeing the video from it. As you do this kind of stuff, it'll make you fall over. So, anyway, I'll just keep talking about this stuff. It'll make a bit more sense in a minute. So what happens is, the way we currently do the Quake thing is we use what's called video overlay. So what happens is you have a virtual world going to the computer, you have the real world getting taken pictures with the camera pumps the video into the computer, the Quake game then takes the video image, overlays the 3D graphics, and then sends them to the display. This example here gives you pretty perfect kind of overlay. The actual head-mounted display is blackened off, so if you turn the power off, you can't see anything. You need the computer's video camera to see what you're doing. This is a really cool technique, though, because it gives you good quality images. You can see the images are sharp, they're well-defined. You get no contrast problems. However, the user can't directly see the real world, and so what happens is if the computer cuts out, well, then you're blind, you have to take the helmet off. You can potentially get sick. If the frame rate of a head-mounted display is not fast enough, what happens is your brain freaks out when it starts to see lag, and some people don't like it when virtual reality systems are lagged by 20 or 30 milliseconds, and after a couple of minutes it'll cause them to throw up. And I've actually had a few people try this out and they felt sick. I don't feel it, but some people do. And it's very hard to... There's been work done on trying to work out what causes it and so forth, but being fully immersed in a head-mounted display can cause problems with getting sick. But this technique is really cool because you can record demos easy. On the laptop, when we chuck it on the back of the backpack, you fold the screen open, and everybody standing behind you can see exactly what the person's seeing when they play the game. So it makes it really good for demos and so forth. Yeah? That's the next slide. This is the next slide. Okay, so the alternative technique, which is what we used to do before, when we had really poor hardware, was what's called optical overlay. The Sony Glasstron and these displays here, if you take the black cover away, the display is actually transparent. You can see through the display as well as see the overlaid graphics. So we used to use these before because to rendering is quite cheap. Basically what you do is you get the Quake game, you turn everything black, and then you only draw the monsters that you want to see. And so in the photo there you can see a monster overlaid over the real world, and everything else is optically sent straight through your eyes. So the real world is nice and sharp. There's no lag problems and everything like that. However, you get problems with registration in that the real world moves, but then the monster will not lock in properly. And the quality of it's not as good either. You'll notice that the image is ghosted. Because of the way the optical combiner works, is it loses image quality when it goes through there's this half-silvered mirror that takes the image from the real world, takes the LCD. Each of them loses 50% of their brightness, so it can send it through to your display. There have been these really cool displays that have come out recently that have laser beams in them that actually paint the image onto your retina. And these lasers are so bright that they can actually overlay imagery while you're looking at the sun, in that you can look at the sun and it's still bright enough that it can draw red or pixels onto your eyes or whatever. You can buy these things. These things have been tested. They work. Like, I've actually used one myself and it was really, really weird. But anyway, so we used this technique for the original AR Quake. What we found was that the quality was poor. Also, when you demo it to people, the people watching the screen on the back of the laptop, all they see is black with just a monster. They don't get to see the imagery being combined. And so the videos, it's just not demo friendly. It makes poor demos, and so I've tended to move away from this technique. This technique's really cool on hardware that doesn't have the ability to do real-time texture map. So, back. So you can see here that the real world is sucked into the optical combiner, and the computer generates an image that's sent into the eye. So it works slightly differently. The paper I've submitted talks a lot about this kind of stuff and how they compare and so forth. So I'd encourage you to read the paper if you want to find out more about how this works. I talk a lot more about how we implement the code as well. I don't really have enough time to go through that today, but it's all in the paper as well. So as I said before, here's some more photos. You don't get simulator sickness, but the quality of the image is not as believable. The whole point of doing this kind of stuff is you want immersion. You want the ability to trick the user into thinking that what they're seeing is realistic enough. And I've tried some VR demos, mostly inside ones, that are so realistic that you actually get the feeling that you're inside. And there was one demo where you actually looked over a virtual cliff and your heart rate goes up because your body's freaking out. because it thinks that there's a cliff there. Your eyes are telling you there's a cliff. Your shoes are telling you there because there's a small ledge there. But in reality, there's just carpet. And they did these experiments testing what would happen if people stepped out, and most people freaked out. It was just weird. I freaked out. I knew what I was doing, and I knew it was stupid to freak out, but for some reason, my body just wouldn't let me. It took a lot of effort to take the leap of faith. So, sorry? No, I've done it, and it's really freaky, because you're stepping out, and your body's saying, don't do it, and you're like, stupid body, what are you doing? Don't do it. Like, it's interesting to sort of see that. I don't know. So anyway, so that's optical, so I don't use that too much anymore. We use these really cool video cameras. The FireWire video camera stuff is really, really cool. Linux supports them really well now. About a year and a bit ago, the support for them wasn't very good, so we used to use USB cameras, like the one at the bottom there. Nowadays, though, the FireWire stuff is cool, and there are these really nice cameras you can buy. There's one that we use called a PGR Firefly, which is actually sitting at the top of that helmet there. It's really tiny. It's the size of a small matchbox. And it's got a ribbon cable that comes off to the board, so you can bury it into the helmet quite nicely. There's a cheaper one that we use. That's this one on the helmet here. This one's about $250, and it's a really good way to get decent video into your computer. These things pump out 640 by 480 at 15 frames a second with RGB. So what it means is that there's no compression, the kernel doesn't have to do any work, the video frame comes in, you send it straight off to the video card, texture map, RAM to be drawn. The old USB cameras, though, they came in like a YUV format or something like that, and the kernel had to do a lot of work to decompress the video. And also, USB's bandwidth is limited to 2 megabits or whatever, so there's a limit to the quality of the video you can send. And so the FireWire stuff's really neat because it's been designed from the ground up to support video, and so we use that, and it works quite well. We've actually been doing some work lately with getting 3 cameras to work at once, shooting in different directions, and the kernel seems to support it quite well, and the bus and everything like that, so we're pretty happy with that. So, okay, so the latest Quake, as I said, uses live video overlays, and what happens is we use OpenGL texture maps to load in the video. So what happens is the video frame comes in, we pass it to the GL card and say, bind a texture, here's the image we want to put on, and then what we do is we then use these stencil buffers to draw in the image. Now what happens is Quake, the way it draws the scene, it most of the times when you're playing Quake, there's always a model or a sky or some texture there. With our stuff, we don't want that. We want actually the video of the real world to show through. And the way we've done it before is that you draw the video first, you then draw the monsters over the top. The problem with Quake is the way it does its rendering is it always assumes that it's always going to be able to draw every pixel on the display. And so it doesn't clear the screen, it doesn't do a whole pile of things in order to optimize it. Now that doesn't work for us. So what we do is we actually use the stencil buffer in GL so that when we draw the display, if we ever hit a texture called black, I think it's on the next slide here. No. Whenever you hit a black texture, we write a bit into the stencil buffer while we draw black to the display. You then draw the monsters in with the stencil buffer set to 0, and then when you finish the display, you say, okay, I'm going to draw the video now as a texture map, but I only want to draw on the pixels with the stencil buffer set to 1. So it's basically, once you've drawn the monsters down, you're building like a cutout piece of paper with holes in it. You then take that and you then spray the video over it using the stencil buffer, and the video fills in any gaps that haven't been drawn properly, and you get the video overlay effect. This is a really bad hack. And making it work with decent hardware acceleration is really tricky because stencil buffers are the one thing that some hardware doesn't do them properly. Some, like NVIDIA's only do them at certain bit depths and not others, and it varies depending on what kind of laptop or desktop unit or whatever you have. So sometimes when you do these hacks, your solution might work, but it's not hardware accelerated, so you have to go around the corner and mess around a bit in order to get the hardware acceleration that you need. Yeah. I played with it for ages, and the trick was is you can do it with alpha channels, but how much performance hit do you take to do it? And the problem was is that the first version I did was overlaid over the top, but it had this ghosting effect because it wasn't done very well. And this was the only way I could work out how to do it. The paper talks quite a bit about how I did this technique. Doing it in Quake's quite tricky. In my software, I do it differently. I draw the video, draw the objects over the top, and it's easy. Whereas Quake is interesting due to the way it does its rendering because it's highly optimized to work on really slow hardware. But it means, I mean, obviously John Carmack was never intending for someone like me to come along and put video in, but the fact that we managed to put it in is quite cool, and it shows the design of his software is still quite cool. We modified the monsters in Quake, so we got the dark monsters and replaced them with nice, brightly coloured ones. The problem with the optical overlay is that everything's really dark as it is, Quake adds its doom and gloom filter over the top of it, and it means you see nothing. But you have to boost all the colors up, and then you can actually see stuff. So this stuff's not so as important in the video overlay version, but in the optical stuff, it was very important. So you can see here the two monsters. We just basically recolored their textures in to make them more prettier. We also disable all the lighting. We disable the shading. Or any effects that cause the lighting to be darkened, we kill off. It doesn't make sense to have dark gloom and doom textures when you're standing outside and it's bright, sunny day. You want the game to sort of match roughly with what you're seeing. So this kind of stuff's sort of important. Let's go to the next slide. So the levels are designed using traditional mapping tools. The texture that is called black is replaced with the video. So I've got a rule in the code that basically says if texture name is black, then do stencil hack, else don't do stencil hack. So anything that's rendered with a black texture is replaced with live video. However, black pixels are not replaced with live video. Only polygons drawn with a particular texture are. We can design different kinds of levels. These are mock-up photos as well. This photo here is an example of just a monster. This one here is an example of a monster with some building meshes. And this here is a fully immersive VR in that you can't see the real world. This is what you can play on a desktop computer right now. This is what's allowed. Our Quake system, by having the video texture, allows you to do stuff like that. So augmented reality is where you've got the real world coming in. Virtual reality is where you're only seeing a computer-generated world. Doing this kind of stuff, there's been a lot of other Quake games that people have done. Cave Quake, which is where they use projector screens and you can stand amongst it. That's all virtual reality based. Ours is novel because of the way we use the video cameras to drag in the real world to play it. So what we did was I had my brother come around and for about a week he sat there measuring up my campus with a tape measure. You can't get models from people because what happens is they give you the model, but these are the models of what they wanted the building to look like, not the way it was actually built. So the models are off, they're different, the bricks aren't in the right spot like they said they would do, and it's just it's too hard to take existing models. So you really need to create your own. Creating models is a nightmare, okay? Now, I've had people come up and say, oh, why don't you just scan in the whole campus and just do it? And it's like, okay, no. The problem is that it's really hard to do. There are techniques involving using laser scanners where you can sweep a beam over a building and measure distance points, and you shoot it from multiple angles. And if you've got trees in the way, you have to shoot it from another angle to get past the tree. And there's all these problems associated with it. And the fact that the scanner costs $500,000 is also a problem. And it can take up to 4 to 5 hours to do it. So modeling buildings is not trivial. And as part of my thesis work, I've been doing stuff with modeling buildings. So we've got some models. We put them into Quake. But it's not really the kind of thing you want to do for fun. It's not easy. You model it, you go outside, you compare the models, no, we didn't quite get it right. Go back inside, make some changes, and you've got to tweak it iteratively. So we did manage to put some models in, but obviously they don't work here. Quake is not really designed to model the real world. Quake is designed to play games on a desktop monitor. It doesn't really have a concept of meters or anything like we're familiar with. And so we have to put all this conversion stuff in so that whenever we load a model in, we've got to scale it and make it fit so that it renders correctly, so the overlay is right. Getting the settings in Quake to make it so it renders in the same way as the real world does is quite tricky, actually, because it's really convoluted internally. It works great on a desktop monitor, but it's not really meant for a HMD for what we're doing. Okay, so we get lots of emails from people. Like, we got flashdotted a couple of months ago, and we had like one photo on the website, and for some reason, someone posted it, and then we had to upload all this content. It was email saying, hey, why don't you use Counter-Strike? Why don't you use Ultimate Tournament? Why don't you use my favorite game here type thing? It's like, well, Quake 1 really works quite well. Quake 2 has been GPL'd as well, but the thing is that all first-person shooters basically have the same limitations. They're desktop games that are designed to draw 3D models while you move around with a keyboard or a mouse. A lot of these newer games do basically the same thing. I mean, the Quake 1 runs with GL, so we've got all the GL stuff. Quake 2 and newer versions, they have better lighting models, better shading models, and all that kind of stuff, and so I turn them all off anyway. So there's no point in having these fancy renderers if all you're going to do is turn them off straight away so you can get them to look right and look right in the real world. So in reality, most of these other games, you don't really gain much by putting new types of engines in. Quake 1's quite extensible. You can load maps in, new creatures, whatever. So it's a suitable platform for playing around with stuff. Any problem is it's getting a bit old and finding tools to play with it are getting a bit hard. Now, can we leave the questions till the end? Because I'm sort of running a bit late. We have other questions. What mods are you going to make in the future? The problem with the Quake games is limitations. I mean, it is limited in that, yeah, you can put a steerable gun in, but the steerable gun will be a two-dimensional gun in that it'll only move a crosshair around. If you want to have a gun that you can do something like this and shoot yourself with it, Quake can't do that. It's too hard to modify it to this kind of stuff. You probably could hack the code and put it in there, but there is a point where it's not worth trying to shoehorn something into something that's not meant to do it. Quake does what it does, but there are limitations. So we're going to be playing with some more game stuff later on, but what we're going to be doing is using dedicated software that's been written from the ground up to support it. Quake has limitations in that you've got to use its crazy map file format, which doesn't allow you to put in really funky shaped objects that are all sort of concave and everything like that. And so really nice 3D renderers can just take VRML shapes and throw them out. And laser scanners and other kinds of devices don't put out Quake BSP meshes, they put out triangle meshes. And converting those meshes into Quake format is a nightmare. I've tried to do it and it's just like, it's evil. And if I can make my life easy by not doing it, then we do it that way. So sort of what we have now is pretty much the limit of what we're going to do with it. Quake's got too many limitations that just stop us from doing things. So can we do multiplayer? Yes, you can. Because we didn't do anything for it, but basically Quake does multiplayer already. So you start a server up and use a wireless card and connect to it and you can play. Desktop versus wearable, the desktop person will always win, because the person just has so much more physics-breaking capabilities than the wearable guy does. Wearable versus wearable is interesting. The trick is just getting enough backpacks, and currently we've only got one that has wearable wireless capabilities, so playing multiplayer is a tad expensive. You get people that say, can I come play the game sometime? No, you can't, because we're really busy. However, I've brought it with us, and you can all play it during the conference. So we're doing a demo during lunch. We're doing a boss tomorrow, stuff like that. Unfortunately, we can't just have people coming to the lab every day to play Quake, because I've actually got to get work done. So I've brought it to the conference so that I can demo it to as many people as possible at one time. So that's what we usually take at the conferences, to demo, but that's usually when we show it off most of the time. Just a quick sideline, I'm a PhD student from UniSA, so AR Quake is just sort of the thing we developed for fun, but obviously we didn't spend $50,000 on a backpack just to play Quake on it. We actually use it for real work as well, so we have architecture, surveying, and building construction uses that I'm currently exploring. One of the tricks with doing AR type stuff is, well, how do you interact with the computer? And the problem is, as I said before, there's no keyboards, no mice. Therefore, it means no GNOME, no KDE, almost no X. Everything that we take for granted on a Linux desktop box pretty much gets thrown out the window. I use Linux as a base platform, but I pretty much just code directly on top of OpenGL, and I do all my own input device handling, because you've got these weird gloves and weird compasses and devices that just aren't supported. And X and all the GUI libraries are designed to handle 2D input devices, but they're not really designed to handle devices that have six axes of freedom, X, Y, Z, heading control, and all this other kind of stuff. So the trick with this kind of stuff is, well, what technology do we have to develop to actually use this stuff outside? So I've been doing work with developing user interfaces based around gloves and 3D interfaces allowed to manipulate objects. So, so what happens, I'll just show you one more video.
This is a demonstration.
Okay, so this is a video I prepared for another conference describing my research work. So what happens is you can walk around outside, and so you can see some virtual objects. This is my custom software I'm using here. The software is a lot more flexible and allows you to do lots of really funky stuff. You walk up to a table, put these gloves on your hand, and you walk up, you press a button, the table gets created. You step back, you can then select the glove and push it back and do things like that. So in this example, we're making a table that meshes up with the real world. So this little video here shows that as you press each finger, we have these blue menu strips on either side. Those show all the available commands that you can currently perform at that moment. So we're currently in manipulate mode, so you've got move, scale, rotate, and so forth. So you don't select a menu option with a mouse because the tracking's too poor. You'll also notice in this video, on the fingertips are little three axis markers on them. The video camera on your head does vision tracking using this library that we got called AR Toolkit, which is GPL. And you can do vision tracking, and you can put a cursor on the hand and you can use it to select objects. So rather than using a mouse or something like that, you can actually use vision tracking to track the location of your hand and interact with objects directly. So, So you can see there we've got two cursors that are mapped onto the markers. And as you move them around, they update in real time. And this is all done in software on the laptop. So what we're doing here is we're using the gloves to create some objects. So we've got some trees, they're transparent initially. Quake can't do this kind of stuff. You can't do real-time modeling immersively with gloves. So this is what I'm talking about when it comes to limitations. So that's why I'm using my own software now to do a lot of this stuff, because it's just too hard. So you can manipulate objects using commands similar to arrow keys. Alternatively, you can grab the object and directly manipulate it. So what you can do is you press the move button and you can move the object around. And the object maintains the same distance from you. It's all done in real-time in hardware. You also pick the object up, scaling techniques, to rotate. It doesn't make sense to click on little handles like you're doing a 2D drawing editor. You want to do something different. You can do rotations. You'll notice that there's a little shadow under the object. That's so you can tell you where the ground plane is. We've got some little widgets around the screen that show you the compass bearing, frame rate. So currently this is running at, I think this is 54 frames per second I'm getting on this hardware right now, so it's pretty cool. This is an example where we created a cube and we modeled a car. So what you can do is you can click points on a cube and then do carving, and the computer blows away all the polygons and creates a surface that looks the same shape as an automobile. This is the modeling problem I was talking about. Doing modeling in 3D is a nightmare. Remember that rule. And so my thesis work has been, well, how can we use AR computers to do 3D modeling outside using the computer? I rock up to a conference, I don't have a model. I want to be able to use my computer to create the models for myself right then and there without having to use a laser scanner, without using a tape measure. So there's some furniture objects we've put down that are floating in space, and you can see my gloves there. Now, this is the really cool part. You can actually jump outside of your body and look around. And the little polygon that's in front of my head is actually the live texture map video. It's not just an overlay, it's actually a fully warped texture map. And as I move closer, so this is what a person would see if they're like in a helicopter, sort of watching the VR view of what's happening. What? No. So you can see there, that's the live texture map polygon as I turn my head around. And it's cool because it allows other people, we're actually doing work with synchronization where I want to serialize my, I've done a lot of work with my software to serialize it over a network so that other people on other machines can watch the live video frames as they're coming in and see what you're doing in real time. You can also use the video camera to capture textures on objects. So if you look at a 3D cube, you look at the cube and press a button and it maps the texture onto the cube based on the video camera you've got. It's a whole pile of stuff you can do, yeah? Okay. Yep. Cool. All right. Thank you very much. Got URLs here. If people want information, I suggest you read the paper. It's got a lot of information in it with stuff in it. And we've got the BOF tomorrow and a demo during lunchtime.